The following Dharma talk was given by Jodi Hojen Kimmel at Zen Mountain Monastery. Hojen Sensei is head priest at the monastery and the abbot of the Zen Center in New York City. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you would like to make a donation or find out more about our various programs, visit us online at zmm.org. Thanks for listening.
Good morning, everyone. Good morning to those of you joining us at home. I'd like to start with two quotes, Nika Thera, and he passed away in 1994. Life, though full of woe, holds all sources of happiness and joy unknown to most. Let us teach people to seek and to find real joy within themselves and to rejoice with the joy of others. Let us teach them to unfold their joy to even ever sublimer heights. Noble and sublime joy is not foreign to the teaching of the Enlightened One. Wrongly, the Buddhist teaching is sometimes considered to be a doctrine diffusing melancholy. Far from it. The Dharma leads step by step to an ever purer and loftier happiness. And this is from the Dalai Lama. It is important to understand how much your own happiness is linked to that of others. There is no individual happiness totally independent of others. I'd say, for that matter, there's nothing, whatever we do, that is not linked to others. And this is particularly true of joy. It's really similar to the experience of knowing our pain and our suffering. So when we begin to know our suffering, it's easier to understand the suffering of others. And through that, to open to compassion and experiencing joy ourselves, we know helps us to experience that in others. So each morning, and maybe other times, we'll chant the four immeasurables, the Brahma Viharas. Brahma is translated as divine, sublime, noble, lofty, pure, immaculate, excellent. Vihara is to dwell, to live in or stay in a lodging or abode. So to dwell or live in an excellent divine abode. And the four Brahma Viharas are loving kindness, known as metta, compassion, karuna, sympathetic joy, mudita, and equanimity, upekkha. And Buddha taught this over and over again in his discourses, the Brahma Viharas, the four immeasurables. Sometimes we call them the divine abodes. I've heard them called the four abodes of love. I've heard them called four boundless minds. But as Dalai Lama said, these are naturally occurring qualities of our heart and mind. Naturally do anything, they're there. They need to be cultivated, but they're naturally there. So when our minds are spacious, these qualities will naturally arise in us. Dalai Lama calls these our spiritual birthright. And I was thinking of how Daido Roshi used to call the creative process our birthright, our spiritual birthright, part of the very essence of who we are. We need only to carefully tend and cultivate them, give them the space needed to fully mature. So, why are they called immeasurable? or boundless or divine. Maybe because there's no limit to how far we can take them. Maybe there's no limit to how much loving, kindness, compassion, sympathetic joy, and equanimity we can cultivate. No limit to how far in the path of enlightenment these ways of being can carry us. Maybe too, because the number or the type of beings to whom they apply is immeasurable. Divine. The motivation to benefit them is immeasurable. The virtues of doing so are immeasurable. And the excellence of the results is immeasurable. So today I wanted to speak mostly to the boundless mind of joy, sympathetic joy, mudita, the third Brahmavihara. The practice of actively taking delight, rejoicing in the happiness of others, rather than feeling threatened or diminished as if the happiness of another takes away from us. Why do I focus on mudita? Guess. May all beings be free from suffering and the root of suffering. May all beings know happiness and the root of happiness. May all beings live in sympathetic joy, rejoicing in the happiness of others. May all beings live in equanimity, free from passion, aggression, and delusion. That the development of positive emotions, we all know, I think, is absolutely crucial for our development as individuals. And these Brahmaviharas, their meditations, are one of the ways we can cultivate that in us. That's why we recite them, perhaps. Life, though full of woe, holds also sources of happiness and joy, unknown to most. Let us teach people to seek and find real joy within themselves and to rejoice with the joy of others, he says. So I remember when we began to chant these, and when we came to the line, may all beings live in sympathetic joy, rejoicing in the happiness of others, I just felt my head go like, and I hope nobody saw me go like, yeah. And I felt myself squirm. And there was a hiccup in this feeling of joy. You know that, Houston, we have a problem. Ever have that feeling from a teaching? Or you get heartburn, like, oh, you know, or it's like gut punched. Oh, I don't know about that one. The rest is okay. Or you can't even listen anymore. Like there's this restlessness in hearing it. Like, don't even mention that again. You know, it's like, enough, stop. And your head starts to go back and forth. Mm-mm. Not me. Not that one. So these problems or pings and pangs we get as practitioners are good to have. Part of the practice of a true freedom diet. So things arise to be examined and felt and discovered, to contemplate. We were doing the ox herding retreat yesterday, learning about the path of enlightenment through the story of the 10 ox herding pictures, and then creating them in our own way. By the way, when we said, I kept hearing the word beings today, and I kept thinking of the bean. Somebody drew a bean with a face, a lentil with a face on it, and I kept hearing, may all beans be free from suffering. Brought me a little joy.
because I kept seeing that little bean head, and I thought, may all beans be free from suffering and the root of suffering. But that these aren't sequential, that they're not a linear line, these 10 ox-herding pictures, that practice is spiral, more of a spiral, that we practice, realize, actualize, practice, realize, actualize, practice, realize, actualize. And then if you remember in Dogen's Genjo Koan, practice, sort of, where is it? It's not mentioned anymore. Why does he drop off practice? Not yet. Not yet, folks. Anyway, the excavation is on, right? How, what is the deeper meaning to sympathetic joy? So when I ask someone how that word landed with them, sympathetic joy, they slightly embarrassed said it made them think of teddy bears sold in hospitals, in the gift store, or those helium balloons that say something nice on it, which could be a way of giving. And as it often happens, these translations from Sanskrit to English aren't, there's no word, there's no one word, no one word for sympathetic joy, for mudita. That's what they came up with. Sympathetic joy, appreciative joy, which when I first read that seemed like bad English. Like, isn't joy this way? Like, sympathetic joy? Like, it was suggesting some kind of work we had to do. I don't know, that's how I heard it. Sympathize, appreciate. Looking in the Zen tradition, Dogen's writings furnish beautiful, numerous examples of what we might call a literary happiness, a kind of happiness enacted rather than discussed, like in the Theravadin tradition. These are part of our very essence of humans. We only need carefully tend and cultivate them. Give them the space needed to fully mature. So this is the maturation revolution. And this especially came to mind over these past 2 years with all that we've been through, all over the world, all the loss, all the fighting, all the killing, the earth. Everybody knows the awfuls well. And when I would ask somebody, how are you? How are you really doing? They'd say, I'm good. Some would say, I'm good. I feel guilty saying that. I know everything is awful, but I'm well. I'm well. And their voices would kind of drop in volume at the end of the sentence as if to say, I don't deserve to have you take joy in my joy. I might even be a terrible person for enjoying my life in the midst of so much pain. Do you ever feel that way? Yeah. And I would say in some way like, no. We need sympathetic joy. It's so necessary right now. It's precisely because there's so much suffering in the world that I've needed it. And I've needed them to make the effort to turn towards places of non-suffering, towards gladness, towards joy, delight, to restore, so that we can face our living challenges. There's got to be balance. Joy is restorative. It's the balance to compassion. Compassion means to suffer with. And so we got to have balance to that. We have to have joy with. I looked up a definition of delight. Delight. Oxford. The word comes from Latin, delectare, derived from delicere. Am I saying that right? Which means to lure away or entice. I didn't expect that. That's delight. So when I sat with it, I began to consider, yeah, sympathetic joy could be as a practice of being enticed away from the ego. That's the joy. I also thought of Dolly Parton singing, "Seems to me if you want the rainbow, then you got to have the rain." They go together. And the more we have one, the more space there is for the other. So it's kind of the invisible side we don't focus on, but it's inherent. It's clear to me that joy is the other side of compassion. It's the invisible partner to compassion. We may not even think that people can be doing well in the midst of so much sorrow. So the Buddha emphasized and taught balance, right? We know, not too tight, not too loose. Not too tight, not too loose. Balance the way, our way of looking at the world, not just by looking at the pain and suffering, but by looking at the happiness you see in other people and in life. The delights there are. Because we know how easy it is to get fed up and depressed, become very depressed. And we think, oh, this is really terrible to live with. It is. What we create, it is. It's terrible to live with. It's true in one sense. And this very thought, if kept narrow and one-sided, that that's all there is, will close down our heart. Do we want this? Or can we turn like a flower to the sun? Where's the sun? That's what makes our bodhicitta grow, our wanting to help and heal, arise, because we feel the sorrow and the harm, and we have compassion. We do have a choice here. And later in the path, we start to recognize that, maybe not in the beginning, but we start to see we can choose. And I told you before, I used to read volumes of Holocaust material to learn about my own tradition that I was raised in, and some of the things hidden and not spoken of, but felt in the body. And one of my favorite people is Eddie Halesium, who found joy in the midst of the concentration camps, and Viktor Frankl, who wrote the book Man's Search for Meaning, and his quote of, "The one thing you can't take away from me is the way I choose to respond to what you do to me. The last of one's freedoms is to choose one's attitude in any given circumstance." The one thing you can't take away from me is the way I choose to respond to what you do to me. The last of one's freedoms is to choose one's attitude in any given circumstance. The reason Eddie Halesium became known was because her postcard was found as a farmer was farming. And she threw a postcard out of the train on the way to Auschwitz, which said, "We're singing all the way to the camps." She had everyone singing on the train. And what kind of joy is this? What is she seeing? What are they seeing? So if the terrible, awful is always how we look into this forest of brambles, is all we see, we become unbalanced. And we're immeasurable. There's so much more to us. And language has so much power. So
May I be free from suffering and the root of suffering and wait for that resonance to come. May I know sympathetic joy, rejoicing in the happiness of others.
Might start going like this. If you stay with it, you might feel it just grow a little bit. That's how it works.
I think this is one of the things most of us deal with. Sometimes becoming very depressed because we hear all the cries and the suffering. But we need to balance seeing people in happiness. What if we meet this all of it, all of it, all of it, that we feel together and allow a simple joy emerge, that we feel it together, that that's the simple joy, that we feel it together.
I heard people were speaking of a talk Gokhan gave with Shantideva, why do we choose suffering? And I thought we could reword that, just a different focus. We could ask, where's my joy and delight right now? Not why do I always turn towards suffering? You might want to ask that, but where's my joy and delight right now? We have to look for this on purpose, for joy, for success, for good things that are happening in the world, which there are good things. And when we shift the focus, we get a sense of inspiration. And we touch that natural joy that our life isn't all bad, that we can rejoice in the goodness of the world, rejoice in the goodness of life, rejoice in the goodness of others. You may feel great resistance just saying that word, rejoice. Delight. And Buddha did teach, if we have that experience of joy, we have a responsibility to share it. It's not for ourselves alone. We don't have to be grim in solidarity. I think of the civil rights movement, and people reported that one thing that attracted them to the movement was the joy of the protesters and being with each other. There's great joy in that, being with each other. You can feel that when you're at a protest. And when we do this, our life doesn't look so bad. People don't look so bad. There is insanity. There is that too. Buddha said that. There is insanity, but not in the deepest level of that person. Not in the deepest level. It's just covered majorly. Why do we resist feelings of joy or happiness or love? Why don't we do it intentionally? We don't do it intentionally. Our conditioning, our habits of mind, our culture move us to build up these walls between what we naturally feel and what we allow ourselves to feel. And I don't know about you, but ironically, that when we are forced in a way to feel intensely, intense grief or sorrow or physical pain, that's what catapults a feeling of joy, when we really feel those other feelings. It's often the intensity, the force that they're coming. Because don't you hear people say, and haven't you said that you're grateful for the losses or the difficulties that you've encountered? Grateful for the shock and how it forced them into intimacy with your life that had been hidden?
Intimacy seems hidden, but it's actually available to us all the time. And once we are willing to directly be intimate with our life as it arises, in that there's a measure of joy, because we're feeling it. Whatever the intimacy is, there's a measure of joy that emerges out of the simplest of life experiences. Something happens. You know, you just hear a pigeon on the windowsill cooing. And you're like, oh, oh my God, right? I am. Or we see somebody's eyes and they're just like glowing. And it's like, we just get this, oh my God, right? Rudy stretching. Just like, ah, oh, it just goes right in us. We just get this, ooh, I feel that. That's so good, right? Just a little bit. We could start with those little things all around us. Or just you feel, you walk out and it's like a warmth. Like it's winter, but you got a warmth on your cheek for a moment. It's like, oh, just like a little woo. Or you really taste an orange. Like, wow, this orange tastes like an orange. That's so great. So wonderful. It's really subtle. And sometimes not so. To stop and allow that surging feeling in our chest to just well up. Fill the universe. Joy wells up when we leave room in our consciousness for it to come. Just leave room. If you don't feel it or find it, just leave some room of the possibility it could enter the room. Some people naturally express sympathetic joy. It blows me away because I've always been like jealous, envious, competitive, nor the other two. But some people, it's just like, you like my shirt? Here. Just give away. Just have this joy when others like love something, just naturally. And I get jealous about that. Jealous about their joy. That happens to us, you know. That's one of the ways it gets hidden. Some people are jealous of our joy, so we hide it from ourselves. And we never find it. We never get it back. We have to go looking again. What was that? Like, that was just like there when I was little or something. Sometimes mudita is described as an antidote to the constricted states of envy and jealousy. What is an antidote? We hear that a lot. What's the antidote? How does an antidote work? Anti means against, right? It counteracts something. We see the word antidote in medicine all the time. We cultivate mudita to counteract and to overwhelm jealousy, envy, judging, the impulse to demean others. And we don't just look at the bottle on the shelf. We gotta apply it, cultivate it, take it. It's hard, because the other's so delicious too, right? We're so used to it. Envy, it's searing. It's like the worst. But it's like if you've done it for enough years, it's like you just keep doing it. So the antidote to cultivate a new neuropathway, a new habit of mind, that will replace the unskillful habits until we see all of it through with a skewer. That's, you know, the Heart Sutra, through it all. Form is exactly emptiness. Emptiness is exactly form. It helps us cultivate easier just to remember. And in cultivating wholesome states of mind, we cultivate spaciousness in the mind, vast and immeasurable, that there's no negativity that can cling to it. That's how we work it. It will arise and it will move on. I was thinking of the line in the Sutra of Great Compassion, where I think this balance is brought out. Kanan Bodhisattva, which is you, Kanan Bodhisattva perceives the cries of the world, and so compassion to suffer with is shown in all its many forms. She liberates all suffering sentient beings and brings them to great joy. The other side. She realizes mind, all beings are one essence. She awakens the heart and nothing is forsaken. We chant, joyful, pure, eternal being. What's that about? Morning mind, evening mind, all of it, all the time. And if we constantly focus on the life force of suffering, it gets to be too much, too overwhelming. We lose contact with the things we love and love to do and love to serve. I think of those on the front lines. I was talking to a doctor at the temple, and I said, how do you not burn out? And he says, well, first I burned out, so I had to know what burnout came from. And then I started, I realized, I love this work. I want to do it. So he started to focus on the delights he would encounter in the midst of all that he was, all the COVID, all the everything that was going down. And he would just somebody saying thank you, or somebody's eyes, or the way their hand touched, or a coworker that they got a little giggle for a moment. A blue curtain blowing in the room. The sky outside. One person was doing hospice work, going from home to home, seeing people in their last stages of being alive. And they loved the work, but it was getting overwhelming. It was just so much pain and suffering in the families. And we talked about it. And so they set up an altar, and they loved the work, so they set up an altar in the ashtray in their car with a little Avalokiteshvara glued it on, made a little incense bowl. And in between houses, they would generate appreciation and joy for who they just met, and thank and gratitude for what transpired, and then fresh. Ready for the next person, rather than dragging all that came to the next one. Words are powerful. Being able to rejoice in our own good fortune and in others challenges some of our deepest assumptions about what can make us happy. Happiness will not go away when it's shared, so it can only increase. So this is a good virus, right? We want to spread this. Yeah, good infection. But this, I don't know why, we're strange, complicated, not complex. Why this sense of insufficiency is programmed into us at the very early age. It's not new. It's not new just occurring in this century. I was speaking to someone at the temple, and in their family, if you did something good, you just pass it by. It's not mentioned. You don't brag. Like, not egoically, but like something good. Nothing acknowledge. To say yes. Like that's good to recognize sometimes. That was good. We hear mostly like, don't do that. Not that. But that was really good. That's beautiful. That made me feel joyful. Nope, you just didn't do it in their family. You just hid it. And sometimes we hide that goodness so well, we can't even recognize it in ourselves. So hidden, we get depressed, and all we see is our mistakes. I went to a years ago,
when I needed it badly. I went to a group thing. It was ongoing for weekends with like 500 or 600 women in one room. Very exciting. And we had to do this. She had us do bragging practice. So we had to learn how to brag to each other. We had to pick a partner and say something like, I did this, right? Because we're so used to like not saying that. And the other person would have to be glad for us and say, well bragged. Well bragged. It was, some people couldn't do it. It took like a couple times to like, they were like able to say what they did that was good. And then the other person to go like, well bragged, sister. The other part of that was complimenting. We had to compliment each other. Truly, find a compliment. Say something nice. And then you had to say, thank you. It's true. And that's all. You don't have to go further. Aren't I like, you know. No, just thank you. It's true. Not easy. It's very skillful. But we'll rationalize our negative emotions. Do you ever find yourself saying, that person gets too much attention? Their head's already swollen. If I say something nice, it's just going to make them more inflated. I never thought I would be quoting Joan Rivers in a Dharma talk, but I happened to be listening to her, and she said, don't expect praise without envy until you're dead. So this feeling of insufficiency, it's not just in the material realm, but it goes into emotional realms. It seems that others have more attention, more love, more luck. There's a sense that happiness is a limited commodity, and when someone else has it, there's less for me. So mudita, sympathetic joy, challenges this assumption. I remember as a child, my mom would pour juice for my brother and I. And we would do this kind of endless whining. Look, mom, his is higher, you know. And in frustration one day, my mom took out a measuring cup and she measured the exact same amount of juice for each of us. So what was the whining about? You love him more than me. It shows because you gave him a quarter inch more of juice. That's an easy one. We act this out in front of others, but inside we're experiencing these painful emotions. Whole nations, ethnic groups, religious groups are taking them out on one another. We see it all the time. What a hopeful gift our practice gives us, the possibility of responding from mature emotions, not from that inner child who really didn't know, who really didn't know. So mudita is like loving kindness is a form of generosity of heart, to be able to let go of envy and wish joy for others, success, without holding back. So last night I turned to, not last night, but during this week, The Book of Delights by Ross Gay. You know that book? It's a good one. He's a poet and essayist, among other things, but the premise of the book is loving in its simplicity. Every day or many days, he decided to write an essay about delight. He delighted in his buttonholes on his shirt. Just, he'd look at them and go like, that is so cool. This buttonhole is just so cool. So he'd write about it. He spotted a praying mantis on a pint of beer someone had left at a cafe. Just got him. High-fiving with strangers pre-COVID. Writing by hand was a great joy. Pulling carrots,
So these are some of his chapters of joy. He says, I realize today I rarely hear the word delight. We speak of happiness, joy at a meal being delicious, but delight does not turn up very often in conversations. He says, maybe it feels too sexy. Maybe it sounds too formal. He says, asks, but are we strangers to delight? We seem more familiar with being hard on ourselves. So to start a sympathetic joy practice by calling to mind our own delights before moving on and contemplating the delights of others. So that's why we're encouraged to say, may I or may we do it both ways. I seem to be, wait a second. Now, how does that happen? Called so delightful when things get out of order. Yeah, right. He writes, one of the best things I've heard anyone say came from one of his students speaking about her aspirations to be a teacher and what she wanted her classroom to be. She says, what if we joined our wildernesses together? What if we joined our wildernesses together? That the body, the life, might carry a wilderness, an unexplored territory, and that yours and mine might somewhere, somehow meet, maybe even join. And what if the wilderness, the densest wild in there, thickets, brambles, bogs, swamps, uncrossable ravines and rivers, is our sorrow, or what is intolerable. Everybody lives with some profound sorrow, something, an illness coming back, somebody, yeah, we know. Everyone has this. And Ross identifies this sorrow as well and tasks, is this sorrow of which our impending being no more might be the foundation, the great wilderness? Is sorrow the true wild, he asks. And if it is, and we join them, your wild to mind, what's that? For joining too is a kind of annihilation. What if we joined our sorrows, I'm saying? I'm saying, what if that is joy?
Thank you for listening. To find out more about ZMM's programs, retreats, and residency, please visit us online at zmm.org.